Welcome to the Florida Grown Femme Podcast,
where best friends Janet and Sage cover everything from sex to Starbucks.
Grab a coffee and join.
Hello, 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 and welcome to another episode of Florida Grown Femmes. I'm Janet.
And I'm Sage.
And today we have a very special topic, a very special guest coming up. And Sage, why don't you jump us in?
Hey, this week we titled the episode, Shove Your Thoughts and Prayers. Usually we have a question, but we're so upset about this. We have no time for questioning. Because we are just so sick and tired of seeing so many young Black people being brutalized by our law enforcement. And what does the Christian community have to offer? Just thoughts and prayers. Like, seriously, shove them, okay? So we have asked some guests to come on and share from their personal experiences and help us understand how we can be better allies. Janet, I think you should introduce our guests.
Yes, these are very, very special guests. I have known them, oh God, I'm kind of aging us, but like, oh, like 10 years,
maybe 10 years.
Over 10 years. We have Savannah and Zach Burkholder in the house.
Hello.
Sorry, our cat keeps meowing.
Wait, can you hear our cat meow?
Little bit. No, I have my dog in the back. We have Sage's
baby. Okay, okay, okay.
We have all the background sounds. So I have known Savannah and Zach for over 10 years. All of us met at SCS, State College of Florida, in our theater program. Go Manatees. Savannah and Zach are, well, I'll just say it, like, Zach is a Black man, Savannah is a white woman. We've all, like with our title, Florida Grown, we have all grown up in Florida, and we invited them on, well, kind of what Sage said. We wanted to talk about real topics with real people and how it's affecting things. So Savannah and Zach, one of my favorite things about you guys as a couple, Sage, you had one of the funnest weddings I've ever been to. Germans can party, but y'all, Savannah and Zach had Elvis at their wedding, and Elvis can fucking party, okay? Like,
yeah, for sure.
You can't compete with Elvis.
Savannah is probably one of the biggest Elvis fans in the world. I mean, I feel like I can say that confidently and no one can come at you. You literally worked at Graceland, and the elf that was there was like, when Savannah calls, I answer.
When Savannah sends me lots of money, I come. Yeah.
Why don't you, like I said, we all met at the SCF theater program, but why don't you guys just jump in and tell us a little bit about your love story?
Okay. So we met at SCF in 2010. So we've been together for almost 10 years in June, which is crazy. Wow. We were 20 years old when we met. Mm-hmm. I was a stage manager. He was an actor.
Any actors listening, literally the best stage manager Savannah to date is the best stage manager in the world. Swoop her up. She's at St. Jude's, but swoop her up, guys.
that's not, considering I had no idea what I was doing. Remember the first time he told me, he's like, do you want to be a stage manager? And I was like, I don't know what that is. And he's like, can you be a bitch? And I was like, yeah. He's like, then you can be a stage manager. So, so when we first met, like, we definitely don't have the typical love story. When we first met, like, I did not like Zach.
she yelled at me the first time we met.
Yeah.
I was late to a, that'll be a running theme. I was late to the first rehearsal, and she met me at the front door and she said, you're late. Those are the first two words she ever told me. And she forced me to give her number and me give her to mine. And I put her in a stage manager, cause I'm like, I don't even know. I didn't even get her first name yet. I still have her in my phone as stage manager. That's I have to change it.
That's cause I still stage manage his life.
Yeah. So I've kept it in there.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah. So we liked each other. Our first kiss was at GT Bray. You were there, Janet.
Yeah, I was in the bottle.
That is not the first time GT Bray has come up on this podcast. I just do.
Jalex, our mutual friend Jalex, I whispered in ears, I was like, dare me to kiss him. And he's like, okay.
I have no idea. I'm just sitting here just like, I got invited somewhere. This is cool. I don't have physical friends. This is nice.
Yeah.
Okay. With people. Cool.
Yeah. He's a video game dude. So a lot of his people are virtual, but yeah. So, you know, it took probably about, a little less than a year for us to really get together, you know, thank you, daddy issues. I was like, I like you. Wait, no, I don't. And then, so I gave him someone's number, Janet, you'll probably remember all of these things. So I gave him someone else's number. I was like, date her. And he's like, okay. Oh, we did. And then I was like, wait, I like you actually, come back. And then that's all there was. We shared a turkey leg at a Florida fair. And then that was pretty much it. Yeah.
It was a very dramatic debut as well. Like it stays.
I remember holding hands.
Okay. You when guys were walking up. To
we were
us.
We were walking up to them.
Yeah.
And you said, can I hold your hand? And I was like, yeah, sure. And we just held hands. And I remember, and I now I realize that like my mind was just like blank, just walking. But now I realize like the planning that went into it. Cause it was literally walking into the full group, knowing everyone was going to be there.
I think Austin,
holding hands, and everyone's just like, oh, there they as they look down to our hands.
I think Austin literally peed in his pants. He's like, what?
Yeah, so, it was a very dramatic moment where it was like we were meeting up with them. And of course they were separate and us not thinking about it. So it was like, you know, also like the carnival lights in the background. You have like this very romantic setup and you see them like walking hand in hand and all of us being like, oh
yeah,
it is done.
Yeah, it didn't really make sense us being together like at the beginning. Like we were very opposite. I was like hardcore driven perfectionist, career minded, college minded, stage manager, you know. Zach, you can describe yourself.
I don't know,
wonderful person.
Yeah, I was about to say, you had all these positives and you're like, all right, now do the opposite. I'm like, I was lazy, didn't know where I was going in life. Like, how was I supposed to do the opposite of you?
No, but really, no.
I was happy. I made other people happy. I was really laid back, carefree.
You went with the flow. Yeah, you were with the flow. You didn't. It's okay to not always have a plan, but Savannah had a plan.
Yeah, Savannah made you a plan. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, and then that's it. Like, honest to goodness, like once we really got together, we moved in like 3 months.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'll never forget. We hit our 6 month and then he was like, I'm going to go tell my mom that I'm moving in with you. I'm like, where the hell do you think she thinks you've been?
I would be home for like a month and she'd be like,
yeah. Okay. And then we moved to Jacksonville together, in 2012 and, lived there for a while. That's where we both got our degrees and then moved to Memphis in 2016. So that's where we live now. So Zach does physical therapy. I worked at Graceland and now I work at St. Jude Children's Hospital. We have a house. We have cats. We finally have money.
Living the American dream.
Yeah. I mean, literally.
We have a fence.
Oh, I know. When we first got together, I mean, like we were broke. Oh, that's why we go to Tommy Bahamas a lot, because when we first met, like we used to, our first date, we shared a bowl of soup and coconut shrimp and that's all we could afford, you know? So now we go and we're like, we'll have one of everything. We have real people jobs now.
That's amazing. So you mentioned, you already mentioned Zach's mom. And just like, kind of like, did she know where you lived or not? And I'm just curious, like, what was that like for you guys, like meeting the families? Were your families like totally open to the other or?
Yeah. So backstory on my family, I'm mixed essentially. I am the only Black person in my family. My growing up, I didn't know my dad. And my mom, brother, sister, and my stepdad, all white. And I grew up in rural Ohio. So no Black people at all. until the age of, I think, 12, I went from living in the country to living in a village. And it's still a village. You can look it up. It's Ottawa, Ohio. There are now more Black people. When I lived there, there were no Black people at all. You didn't see anyone who looked like me. So that, you know, that changed things. So moving to Florida, of course, you went from one in a million to a million and one. And it was, you know, pretty good culture shock. So for me, like Savannah coming over and being integrated into the family was like natural. It's like, yeah, sure, no problem. There was no stigma to hold up or any sort of cultural barrier in that way, at least for race, to integrate into my family. Right. Savannah's family, on the other hand, is a little bit different.
And before we move to my family, since he brought up Ottawa, I think something really interesting about Zach that I feel like, you know, I've discovered over the years is, you know, Janet and I both know Zach to be a comedian. He's the class clown. He's funny. But, you know, there's a debate about who's funnier. I am funnier.
No, it's okay.
No, whatever. So the point is that, you know, back in the day, you know, he was the only black kid. And so like, he's told me in the past that, you know, people would come over to his house, like while he was in the yard and like, look at him and watch him because he was the only black kid. But then Zach, I think subconsciously thought it was like, I'm going to put on a show and they're here because I'm funny, you know? And I think that's really made him into who he is today. Is he's such a funny comedian type person. You know, he's the life of the party. And I think it really is rooted in literally people just
staring at you. You have one way, you either like intrinsically, you just go deeper in and
right.
Or Zach, you put on a show. And that's true. Zach on a stage, he can put on a show.
Right.
Actually just naturally talented, nothing to do with trauma.
Whatever.
Yes, moving on.
All talent is rooted in trauma. Okay. But anyway, but yeah, so my family, you know, I'm from a very, very small town in Florida, right?
You might not even know the name of this town that you
are from. It's called Wauchula, Florida.
Wauchula. Wauchula. It's real.
Wauchula. Yep. Home of what used to be the cucumber queen. We used to have the cucumber king and queen. It's very small. I think it's got like 15,000 people. There's about 500 churches. I mean, not really, but you know, it's a really, really rural town, rural. Very few African-Americans there. And
I would say for those that listen to stuff, you know, I think Florida gets a reputation of like, we're South, but we're not Southern, but Wauchula was Southern.
Middle Florida is Southern.
Is Southern, yes. And racist.
People the truth.
Yeah. Right. So, and it's hard for me because, you know, I want to respect where I came from. But at the same time, you know, they didn't respect me. So I do want to be honest. You know, when I grew up, I was not raised to be liberal. I will say, you know, in defense of my mother, because she's my best friend in the world, I was not raised to be racist either. You know, she is not a racist person. She is a loving person. I love her dearly. A lot of my compassion comes from her. However, mm-hmm. I was also not raised to not be racist in terms of my community, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And being anti-racist and just considering yourself not racist, I think there is a difference, right? Yeah. Being not racist is not speaking up, but being anti-racist is saying like, hey, it's wrong to be racist, guys, you know? Yeah. So I remember the first time I ever met a gay person and my life was changed. Like, that's just it. His name was Rene Perez. And I had never met a gay person in my life. And there's just something in my head that like clicked, you know? I was super in church. I thought I was being called. You what?
How old were you at that time?
I was my first gay person, 14 or 15, maybe.
Yeah.
First gay person.
That's great. That's probably a good thing.
Yeah. So my life changed after that. I became really liberal. I met some amazing people in Lake Wells, which was a neighboring town, you know, Danny Mason, you know, an amazing person. I'm trying to remember their correct pronouns. They prefer they, them. So I'm trying not to say him since, you know, that's how he identified back then. But, you know, they were an amazing person in my life, huge impact in why I became the liberal person I am. But in terms of racism, you know, I didn't really have many black friends in high school because there weren't a lot of black people. But, you know, recently I remember one of my black acquaintances from Wauchula was like, I remember you were the only one who like treated us kindly. And this is like real racism. Like our senior year, like they would all stand according to race. So all the Asians stood together, all the blacks stood together, all the whites stood together, all the Mexicans stood together. And if there was ever a fight, it was a racial fight. Things like they would throw a noose into the tree where the black people would stand.
Holy shit.
Let's
put some years on this because I think one thing I will get to and stuff is
couldn't have been more than 15 years ago.
Well, I'm just saying, like, you know, I think a lot of times people think that part of the conversation that comes up is racism isn't real. Like that's dead.
Or it's over now.
So, or it's not like we hear conversations and stuff with dumb things now where like sexism isn't a thing anymore. And it's like, that's crazy. And then when Me Too happened and stuff, and now like people are also trying to say, well, it's not as bad as it was. It's like, no, this was 2008, eight.
Yeah. So I graduated 2009. So this would have been between 2000, like 6 to 9 or something like that.
And I guess, you know, cause we're still going through the love story thing, but a pin for a later discussion is there's a difference between overt and like subterfuge when it comes to racism. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, because I also spent some time living in Montana, and we can get to that in a bit. And so when you're in an environment, like she said, I'm not racist, but, and a lot of people don't understand that it's the subtle racism that is kind of like laying under the surface of culture and of words and actions. That is the hardest one to identify, and it's probably the most oppressive, but we'll get to that at another time.
And unlearning racism, right? Like I don't consider myself a racist person, but every day I am unlearning how to get away from the statistic racism that I was around. You know, like it is a process. Just because I find myself to be a liberal white woman, you know, who votes Democrat, does not mean that I don't struggle with I don't want to say racism, but I struggle with having a prejudice, you know, like we all have a prejudice, whether we want to say it or not. We do.
Also, I don't want to say victims to our surroundings, but we right. grow like there is an influence on the environment that we grow up in.
Absolutely. So. Absolutely. So, you know, in high school, I'll never forget Obama, you know, came out for the first time and I was like, that's it, voting for Obama. He was going to be my first president I could ever vote for. I put it all over my car. I put it in my certain place of work, and they told me I had to come and take it down. Ooh. And I was like, yeah, no, not going to. And then whenever he got elected, they all wore black the next day to act like they were in mourning. And like, I would be driving down the street and I had Obama all over my car, and people would like flick me off or yell at me or whatever. And it's all because Obama's black. Like, mm-hmm. let's not really, his biggest sin was being a black man, not being a liberal. That is the kind of place that I came from. And from a further background of my family, and you know, it does make me feel guilty to say these things because I love my family, but facts are facts. You know, back in the day, you know, if you think that my family was not a part of the KKK, they were, right? A certain member of my
family. You can't ignore that. You know, that's also, right. I think, people listening and stuff too. You're not alone, Savannah.
Right.
There's a lot of people that probably a little afraid to go a little, to even just two generations back, look into what their family was into in the South and stuff. And that,
for sure.
More than stuff. Like,
I do want to make a statement though, that those, whoever that was potentially in your family way back, they must be like turning over in their grave that you married a black man.
I want to dance on their graves. Honestly. I want to dance on their graves. Yeah. Well, there was my mom remembers like her family members, like whenever black models came out in magazines, ripping the black models out before she would put it on the table. So like, and then in Wauchula, so I'll show you just how bred racism is or prejudice is within you. You know, I will totally throw myself out there right now. We called the portion where the black people lived in Wauchula the quarters. And I never knew what that meant. I was like, I remember, I think it was like, honestly, within the last 10 years that my mom and I were talking, and she said something about the quarters. And I was like, yeah, you know, oh, are the quarters in the same place? She was like, yeah, you know, whatever, just casual conversation. I'm a super liberal person at this point. And then I was like, what does quarters mean? And she's like, oh, slave quarters. So that's what it's still referred to. Okay. Yeah. Still referred to as that. So that's where I'm coming from, people.
I'm literally speechless.
I mean, I also need to say too, like, for everybody know, like we said this, like Sage and I are from Bradenton. Wauchula is only an hour away, guys. Like right. It's not like this is right. In the backyard. Wauchula and Bradenton are basically on the same border. Like that's the next town in. You go to Wauchula, I remember you saying like you would go to Bradenton to go into the city.
Like, yeah. Bradenton, I was like, I might as well be in Miami. This is like, it was completely different. And that's really why I fled there. I fled there so much as a little girl. My aunt lived over there, and she was, mm-hmm. she's conservative now. She's drank the juice, but you know, I would always go over there to just kind of get a break. And again, Wauchula has wonderful things about it. And I, you know, I'm blessed to have been raised there to a point, you know, the country and my granny and all that kind of stuff. But you know, I'll never forget. I posted something about the Confederate flag, and I had someone reach out to me from Wauchula, and they're like, oh, well, I just need you to know, like, I'm not racist, even though I have Confederate flags in my house. And there are good people in Wauchula. There are people who are not racist, but there are also people who say, I'm not racist, and then you fly a Confederate flag. You are, right? Mm-hmm. So it's time for some self, you know, awareness, right?
And to that point, so like Savannah mentioned, I work in physical therapy.
Yeah.
And I work, right now I work in with people with chronic pain, and you know, my demographic skews back and forth, but right now, majority of them are, I probably say about 70 plus. So a lot of my patients are just old timey. So I've had patients who I work with. I've had a few who I work with who will ask to work with another therapist so they can feel more comfortable. I've worked with one woman in particular. She's just like, nothing against you. I just don't feel comfortable. And you know, you respectfully.
See, and that, and I am going to get teary because that pisses me off.
Yeah, Savannah, feel what you're feeling. I also just have to ask, like, Zach, like, how do you, like, I mean, it's emotional hearing that, and you're just telling your story. Like, how do you feel in those moments? What do you do?
So I think it's, again, when I was talking about, you know, what's overt and what's kind of under the surface, someone who is, when you accept that at a different time, people did different things. When they were younger, their environment, the product of whatever environment they were, there was a certain culture, and you grow up believing that something is right. And it's not always something is wrong. You just say something is right. And then you don't speak about the opposite, because speaking about the opposite means you have to face it and talk about it. So when you have someone who says, you know, only these people eat here, or only we trust these people, you speak about that, but you don't say, we don't like them because. You just say, we like this group of people. And you look at the other group of people and you just stay silent. It's that kind of thing. And so if I have an older patient who acts that way, I'm not angry at them, because it's not even
image.
It's not the image of me per se. It's the bias against what I am. And I know that there is no changing that. At a certain age, they'll get set in their ways or their beliefs. And I guess when you're surrounded by it, you either have to accept it and understand, or rally and fight against. And there's a time for both. I'm not going to fight my 95-year-old patient who can barely walk from room to room about their predisposed prejudice against me. I mean, that's ridiculous. I accept that. Okay. In her time, she had a narrative, and that narrative was fed by every media outlet, by every source. And then when other voices came out, they were rebellious voices. They were rising against all the morals that you held near and dear. They were I'm fighting against what is really good about our place. How dare you threaten what's good? And how dare you use things like violence and disrupting us by stopping our traffic, by standing in front of places, whether it's a sign and peaceful protest or whether it's yelling and screaming. They're disrupting. And that disruption makes you feel negative and bad. So when you work with a patient, you're like, okay, I can understand this. If someone says, I don't feel comfortable, okay, I can understand. It's one of the things that you either learn to or you get mad about. And I've just come to understand it's the same thing with Savannah. And once she gets into her discussions about her family, you have to have that understanding.
But that's also because Zach is a very loving, kind person. I want to meet these people out back and beat their asses into the ground. So you know what I mean? Like, it is balanced in terms of how we react.
Because
you make a very like logical argument with it, Zach, with like, I mean, yes, okay, maybe with a 95-year-old patient, you pick your battles because they're a product of their environment at that time. But I guess my question is like, where, like if you're 70 and under and not in a nursing home, do you need to reevaluate? Where's the cutoff? And right.
I think it's important that nobody gets a free pass to be a racist, right? So like, you just don't anymore. And this is how, and we'll, now that it's been like 30 minutes, I'll finally tell you about my family, but you know,
we'll shelve that and go to the family.
No, but this is a good segue because, you know, my mentality when we first got together was like, you know, ignorance can be taught, but hatred cannot. All right. Mm-hmm. So I can handle ignorant, you know, ignorance can be taught, hatred can't. So I've had people in my family and in my life who are ignorant, and that's okay. I will help educate you. And I will have patience for you to unlearn your racism, right? If you're just hateful, I'll cut you off and you're done.
I think the other thing too, it's one thing for us to say, and again, we have to just acknowledge, like, you and I are white. Us going up to another white person being like, okay, don't be racist, and Zach being in a situation of like picking your battles of when you can actually say that to everyone. I don't know, even just hearing like both of these stories, it's like, I agree with both of you. I was like, yeah, kill him. And the other part, I'm like, no, compassion. They don't know.
And because the simple truth is that I have to make a decision. You asked about the 70 and you're, gosh, we keep bouncing back and forth. Let's say someone does something, racist or not, okay, hateful or not, whatever, whether they are willfully ignorant of it or if they are trying to make a point, whether they're being subtle. If I fight it, what do I look like? What do I look like? I look like that guy who got really angry. It's all about race. Let me cement in your mind.
Well, you just look like the angry black man.
Yeah. Let me give validation to the image that you've been holding. Mm-hmm. And so that you can use that for fuel for the rest of your life. Yeah. I remember this one guy came up to me, tried to fight me. Yeah. Talk about racist. I'm not racist. You allow them to have fuel for their fire. Mm-hmm. But if you come at it with maybe logic, maybe understanding, and you present it in a way that is different, then you force them to look inwards. No one ever changed their opinion by yelling at them. If I yell at them or if I try to force myself or my acceptance on them, they'll only dig in. So that's why you can't always fight. You can't beat that person up.
But that's why you use your white privilege as a white person to fight back. Because while he may need to walk the line, you know, as an African-American man, I don't freaking have to, you know, I'm going to say, yeah.
Hear that, white women listening, that,
well, yeah. And what I see from my black friends, from the black community, is you're also exhausted from walking this line, from having to, you know, oh, okay, should I say something? Should I not? You know, and I think us white people, like, we do need to step it up. But when we see it in action, be like, no, you need to get in your place. Don't be fucking racist.
But when you do, be ready to be gaslit by your other white friends who don't agree with you. So definitely a lot of gaslighting from my part in terms of families. And at the beginning, you know, when I first introduced him and I told my mom about it, you know, she was nervous because she was nervous about how my family would react.
I remember being nervous to have Zach going over. Like, I remember that being like, oh God.
Right. Right. I mean, even like walking through town, like in Wachula, like I was a little bit nervous, but also like I was so liberal that I was like, I dare you to say something. I was walking through Main Street holding his hand. Nobody's even in Main Street. Okay. And I was like, say something. But, you know, it was a little rough at the beginning. I think a lot of whitewashing happened in order to make it more palatable for them. You know, some people would be like, oh, he looks Bahamian. He looks like he's from the Bahamas. So that was easier for them to be like, oh, I think you look Bahamian. You look like you could be from the Dominican Republic. You're not an African American. You know what I mean? Like, even though those are still African Americans, it definitely, they were trying their best to make it as palatable for them as possible.
Instead of saying, in their mind, they were justifying. Yeah. They were finding
instead of being like, Savannah's husband's black. Well, he's from the islands. That was better for them. Right. But no, he is German and Haitian. So a couple of things that happened was that, you know, someone very close in my life, like, wouldn't shake Zach's hand when they first met. Oh my gosh. Loves him. Whenever someone found out that I was dating Zach, and this was, mind you, after 6 years, I mean, I was already at Graceland. The conversation was, so thought you should let you know that your daughter's dating an N-word. Yeah. What else? I mean, there was crazy things that, another person had said, I don't want you to end up alone, divorced with mixed babies. And this is the same person who told me when I was little, be careful because black guys love big blonde girls.
Wow.
So be careful. That's what I was told. So, and of course, you know, we have had it easier than a lot of people, I think. We haven't had to deal with that much, but we've still had to deal with some things.
Not nothing, the things that you just described.
Yeah, everybody, the things that you described are insane.
Right.
Yeah.
Biggest one, and I will say who this is. So speaking of daddy issues, you know, my biological father left when I was one, but I had a dad that I had the majority of my life up until about middle school. And he was still in my life throughout high school and such. But I remember when he found out that I was dating someone who's black, and he called me and I said, you know, I want to bring Zach to Christmas. And he's like, you know, he just kept saying, that's not cool. That's not cool. I don't know how your mom raised you, but that's not cool. Can you drop him off somewhere?
Wow.
No.
Right. So then I go to my dad's house. I called him my dad. I go to my dad's house. I'm like, okay, Zach, just wait for a second. I'm going to run in, grab my gifts and leave. Now, mind you, someone who was in there was dating a member of my family, and that person was abusive, had thrown this person up against walls, but was allowed to come in because he's white. Right. Then you have this damn near perfect human who has never even called me a bitch in 10 years. And he's not allowed to come in. I just remember sitting in there and being like, my husband, well, he weren't my husband then, but my boyfriend is sitting out there not allowed to come in because my dad is racist. I remember driving away feeling so guilty. My mom was so pissed. She's like, he should never even went in. Screw him, whatever. And I just remember like, I'm never going to let myself or Zach feel like that again. I'm never going to leave my black boyfriend in the car ever again. Mm-hmm. And I have not spoken to him in like 7 or 8 years.
And that was when we got together, that was one of those situations where you're like, why don't you just go out there and walk up to that apartment? I can get in there. My girlfriend is, you do something like that. And once you allow someone to kind of see the wrongness of it, that's when change happens. So had I made a big deal out of it and made the event more stressful for Savannah and all this, fuel to the flame, you get in arguments, I'm going to text or call them too much. But once you just sit there and think about it, that's when people are like, oh, wow, I guess this is how it is. And it's the same way with when we wanted to get married. No, it's 7. I to get married because we've been married for 2 years.
That proposal was great.
I have a question before you like go. Yes, I want to hear the proposal, but okay. So that Christmas, it's Christmas. You're sitting in the car waiting for your girlfriend. Mm. Like, what kind of thoughts are going through your mind in that moment?
So it's hard because at this point I'm 16, 17. No, I'm like 19, 20. Huh? I'm counting up.
Benjamin Button ass. Yeah, are you talking about?
I'm counting up. I have to go.
We were like 20, 16 or 17. I don't even know. Yeah,
don't
worry about it.
I'm terrible at this. I also have no concept.
She's like, and I was 5 years old.
So regardless, let's say I'm 25 or something like that in the car, right? Okay. Whatever.
You were 25.
Sure. At this point, I'm so used to it, it doesn't matter. And this, again, a sad thing. Savannah's talking about this moment where I'm sitting in this car, and for you guys are like, oh my gosh, I don't remember that day, because it doesn't matter. It's so under the radar for me that it doesn't even affect me.
I cried all the way to Bradenton, and he was like, la, la, la.
Yeah, because that's how it is. I mean, once you get down to it, again, you can only get angry for so long. You can only get that gut-wrenching feeling for so many years. You can only not have a word to describe how people look or treat you because it's so skin deep that you would take a detective to figure it out. And within a vacuum, you can never figure it out. It's only until you listen to other stories or figure other things out that you realize, oh, that's what this is. So at that moment, it's just like, okay, I'm in the car because someone's racist. Okay. Like, that makes sense. Like,
didn't we hide in the closet once?
So again, not to name names. One time when I went over to her house in Wauchula, a member of her family was coming over. So I had to hide under the bed. Now,
no, not on the bed, in the closet.
In the closet.
But I also had to hide my gay friends there. So like, I used to, you know, have my gay friends weren't allowed in the house, not because of my mother, but because someone else. So like, they were not allowed. Like, they had to, like, literally, they're like, stay on the porch.
It was under the bed.
Was it under the bed?
Under the bed. Yeah, because the closet had like your stuff in it.
Well, my gay friends went in the closet. So yeah. Black people are under the bed, gays in the closet. That's how it was. But,
and again, what's the chances of me losing to a grandpa? None. Like, I'm pretty confident in my ability to take out grandpa. And I'm pretty confident in the ability to stay in a house and wait for grandpa. If he comes at me with something, I could, whatever. That's not the point. I remember thinking, man, I really would hate to make this visit inflammatory. Let me just hide myself, because I can shelve my emotions at that moment to make sure that me being here is comfortable for everyone involved. That's my thought process. I'm like, okay, in 10 minutes, the person will be gone. I can come out from under the bed. We can have a wonderful a weekend, and the emotional strain can be on me, and I can live with that. But had I been out there, had he seen me, then it's a family discussion. Then it's a fight. Then a rift is formed. And it's just, to my mind, just not worth it. But
people are not going to, not all of them come around, you know, on my wedding day. And I won't say that it's all because of racial things, because it wasn't, you know. Mm-hmm. I probably had 4 people in my family at my wedding, you know. Now, I was a rebellious teen, so I pushed a lot of my family away before I even got a black boyfriend, to be honest, because I was rebelling against, you know, small town living in general and being conservative. Some people have come around, but it's also one of those unspoken things of where they've never met him. My grandmother, you know, I'm not going to say she's racist or anything. You know, she's grown a lot, hasn't met Zach in 10 years. you know, a lot of my family members have never made a point to meet Zach. They say that they'd be willing to, would they? Maybe. But, you know, when you are, and when he talks about these things, I feel such guilt because I'm like, why did I ever let my Black boyfriend hide under the bed? But, you know, as someone growing up in the South, as a white woman, nowhere compared to what Zach went through, but I also was going through a, what do I do? How do I not upset my family, upset my mom in association, not for having a Black boyfriend, but, you know, my mom is the one who has to stand with Chula and deal with this. So what do I do? You know, now I think for us both over the past few years, we've, and you know, this phrase is so overdone, but we've become way more woke of like, we're not going to deal with that anymore. Like if that was me nowadays, I'd be like, get your ass out of the bed and from out from under the bed. And we're going to go out here and you're going to be forced to say something to him, or we're just going to leave. And that's why I don't go back. And you know, some of my best friends from Wauchula, you say you're not racist, but when a Black man is suffocated for 10 minutes, you say nothing. Thing, you know, and that feels like a direct correlation to you don't support me then. You don't support our relationship then if you can't voice that this is wrong. Right. Or if you have to come to me and say, I'm not racist because of my Confederate flag, but I love you and your husband. No, then you just love me. You don't love my Black husband.
Yeah, you know? I think the Confederate flag thing for a lot of it drives me nuts, like for so many different reasons and stuff, and like what you're saying and stuff. It's like for that person that said that, like, and maybe they listen or not, like how the fuck is Savannah and Zach supposed to believe that you're not racist when you are like flying the racist flag? Like that's right. What the racist you. So how are we supposed to know differently? If you're cooking right. yourself in this, I'm supposed to believe that you're not, like right. ridiculous.
And things take time. They unlearning racism takes time. Like I remember when I was a teenager, I'll never forget, they had these dumbass Southern shirts. I don't know if y'all ever remember them, but they had like Confederate flags on them. I don't remember what kind they were. And I remember being like, well, you know, I understand what you mean about it's heritage, not hate. Yeah, I can understand all lives matter. Like I will throw myself under the bus and say, like, when this whole movement first started, I was like, but wait, don't all lives matter? Like, and I'm a liberal person. And I was like, don't we all kind of matter? But now I'm like, I've got a Black Lives sticker on my car. You know what I mean? So it takes time. Even if you're a woke liberal white person, if you have been raised in the South, you do have to unlearn racism.
Yes, 100%.
And every day is a learning opportunity. I still say things sometimes that I'm like, okay, damn, bitch. You know what I mean? Like,
one time Savannah did come to me and.
What are you about to call me out on something? don't say I said something terrible. What did I say?
No. I'll allude to it, and if you want to talk about it, you can.
Okay, go.
We won't out you on that one or this one. Just this one.
Not that I'm like in my house saying something terrible, but you know.
There was in my life, there's a habit that usually happens, and Savannah was alluding to it when she said whitewashing. When you try to de-escalate, and so instead of saying, you know, oh yeah, he's Black.
Oh yeah.
Oh, he's Bahamian. Yeah, yeah. Instead, you say, well, he's not like they are.
Or, I have never said that. No, what you're...
No, I'm not saying that you did. That's what I'm saying. I'm not outing you. I'm saying I'm making an example.
right. Y'all are going to have to change the title to racist wife, Black husband.
No, it's the habit of saying, well, he's not like that, or no, he's half
no,
white.
No, I'll tell you mixed. Exactly what I used to say.
Things like that.
I used to say.
Now she can talk about what she's.
No, I used to say I'm Blacker than he is. Mm. Okay. Mm. It really, honestly, I'd be like, oh man, I'm Blacker than he is. Now I'm from Memphis and this is a heavily populated African-American community. I have more Black friends here than I ever have in my life because I'm exposed to more Black people. So in a lot of them, they do. They're like, Savannah, you're Black girl. Like deep down you are Black. Like, and that's what they say to me all the time. So, you know, I used to make like a very lighthearted joke of like, well, I'm Blacker than my husband is, you know? And without really realizing that I am discrediting his Blackness.
Or just saying that I'm white.
Right.
Most people say that I'm white.
Right.
And again, I'm raised in Ohio. My whole family is white. So people are just like, no, you act more white than anything, you know? And it's.
But what is whiteness? You know, does whiteness mean I talk, you know?
I enunciate correctly.
Exactly. Yeah.
I have verbose verbiage.
Why is that whiteness? Yeah. And for me, even like he brought it to me one time and he was like, Savannah, when you say stuff like that, it, you know, more or less it hurt his feelings. And I never, ever thought of it like that. And I think over the years, you know, oh, why am I crying? I'm on my period. That's one of the reasons, but fine, you know, yeah. It's like you downplay everything, you know, and a lot of, there's a lot of guilt associated with, you know, how I've handled some things in the past, but sometimes you can only do what you can do, you know, mm-hmm. being raised in a certain town, you know, 18, I think I left Wachula literally when I got my diploma, 18 years of conditioning does not go away in 10. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I feel like I definitely tried to make myself smaller and Zach smaller and fit into a box for it to be more palatable for people at times. That is something that is not the case probably within the last 4 to 5 years, definitely moving to Memphis, where I'm like, you guys can suck my ass on all of it. You know, like I do not care. My husband is Black. I'm proud of that. My children will be Black. I'm proud of that. You know, and even like some of my family, I can feel it that when they hear about, when they talk about my children, they talk about how light skinned they'll be, like almost like a don't worry, they're going to be light skinned. And I found myself wondering how Black will they be? Not because I'm scared of them being Black, but because I'm like, you know, of course I want my kids to look like me a little bit, but like, will they have hair like me? Will they have skin like me? When I pick them up from school, are they going to be like, an ID, please, ma'am? Because you look nothing like your Black children, you know?
Right.
So all of those things are important. It's not, I don't know how to say this properly, but it's not wrong to feel a certain type of way necessarily, but it's wrong to sit there and stew in it and not grow from it. You yeah. know, like we've all been prejudiced in our past. It's not necessarily because we've been raised like that. You almost can't help it. But what you can help is growing from it, looking yourself in the mirror and saying, you know what, as a white person, you know, like that one song from Avenue Q, everybody's a little bit racist sometimes. You know what I mean? And it's okay to be like, wow, I still have some prejudice in me. Yeah. I need to fix this.
Well, also anybody, because also for the Christians out there that are saying that, like, I'm good, like, I'm not racist, I don't need to work on this, I'm good. Fucking bullshit. Like, we are yeah. called to grow. And so right. for you to, like, look at yourself and be like, I'm good, that's fucking bullshit in your ego in play.
Right. And if guess
you
what?
If you have something to work on, you know that right now that God is right. going to move in you to be like, that's bullshit. We can all grow.
And Jesus was not a white man. He was a dark-skinned Middle Eastern yeah. man. And if he went through TSA, he get checked twice.
Like, yes.
It's just the truth. And growing up, Jesus was whitewashed for me big time. I think I was in my early 20s before I realized he was a Jewish Middle Eastern man. Truly. Yeah. And it's just not okay. And, you know, Trump, as much bad as he's done, my God, he has bred so much goodness because the goodness has risen from the ashes. We have had to come out and be like, you know what? I'm done with this bullshit.
Ooh, that was messed up. Okay, never mind. My bad, guys. My bad.
Yeah. It really showed a lot of white people, I think, that it's not good enough to just not be racist. Now you have to be anti-racist and speak up. And check your own self in the mirror and be like, all right, what childhood traumas are causing me to have the opinions and thoughts that I have today?
So yeah. in my point of view, again, going back or not going back with Trump, well, and I was talking about it before, but I only lived in Montana for about 5 months or so. And, you know, things stick out in my mind. I remember we went down. Now, I have an older brother. He's 2 years older than me. And he's everything that I'm not when it comes to confrontation. Again, since an early age, I learned to walk a line, whether it's family dynamic, whether it's my skin color, whatever. I'm always trying to understand people because I know that for a majority of my life, no one took the time to understand me. I realize that what's important to me is that I'm going to take that time because I've been there where people judge you immediately. You have no recourse. There's nothing you can do about it. You're judged. and people will treat you because of that. So I've taken a lot of time to try to understand people. And I remember my brother doesn't do that. So we're downtown in Montana. We're downtown, me and my brother, we're younger, probably about 11 or 12 or so. We go to a billiards place. My brother goes into the bathroom. He's like, go ahead and just get us a table. Like, go up there. And I ask, hey, you know, do you guys have a table available? He looks at me and says, nope. I'm sorry, we don't have any that we can rent. And the billiard room has no one in it. There's no one there. I'm like, darn. You know, I just take things at face value. I come out and I tell my brother, I'm like, hey, they can't rent. He's like, what? He walks up. Hey, come in. Yeah, man, pick whatever table you'd like. I remember my brother getting mad at this. I remember it because I couldn't understand. And I was worried. I'm like, brother, why are you getting mad? But he was pissed. We ended up leaving. And there have been moments in my life where that has happened and other people have gotten pissed that I didn't realize why they're getting angry, because I'd been so conditioned to just brush it off. Little things like my brother getting offered a very nice, expensive watch as a going away gift, whereas I have to pick off the little tray thing at Walmart. Going back when I was in elementary school, I was in fourth grade. And they have the gifted program, which is amazing. And everybody wants to do it. And me and my friend were in a project and we made this project. And again, we're living in a village. So it's like, go see the principal and show them this project, because you have that time when you're in a village and you're a principal. He went first and I was still in class and I meet him in the hallway. He's like, we're getting into gifted with this. And I'm like, what? Let's go. I'm so excited. I walked into the office and I'm like, hey, he told me that we're getting into gifted. And the principal's like, well, I'm not exactly sure if that's appropriate. We'll have to see. I was like, oh man, darn. I went back home and I told my mom, man, I didn't get to get, whoo. My mom called that principal. I got into gifted.
Yeah.
It was when I was in that same school, I had a journal. Like every day you wrote things down. And I remember we had watched Men in Black. So I wrote about it. I watched Men in Black. It was a lot of fun. And in the cover of Men in Black, there's Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith holding their guns, right? That's the image. So I drew that. It was the front of the thing. I got Saturday school. Granted, maybe I'm in third or fourth grade. I got Saturday school. I remember they pulled me into a classroom. They looked at me and they said, do you know what happened at Columbine?
What?
And I'm like,
I've never heard this.
Third or fourth grade. So I'm a child. And I'm like, I don't even know what is a Columbine. And the yeah. Columbine shootings had happened.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Another time in that same school, I'm a class, you know, again, I'm pretty, again, I don't like the weird tooting your horn thing. I'm intelligent. I'm smart. I can get information. I can digest it. And I keep going. And when you don't stimulate my brain, I get bored. So in classes, I'd run around, you know, circles around these kids in classes and I get bored because they're, you know, learning things that are way under me. So I'd talk, I'd joke, I'd laugh. That's who I am. I'm exuberant. I'm an extrovert. My teacher, when I came back into class one day, she had talked to me about, you know, being out like that. So I came back in and everyone else went out to recess. And she said, this is what I'm going to do. So she pulled my desk out from everyone else's desk. She took white tape and she put a square around the desk. And she said, you can do whatever you want in this square, but you cannot disturb anyone outside of it. And I had to sit on the outskirts of the classroom in the back corner by myself. And I couldn't make any noise outside of it. I could sit on there. I could throw my pants off if I wanted to. But I could not make a noise beyond that square.
Were you the only Black person in school?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this is third, fourth grade. Mm-hmm. So when you ask me about, were you upset in a car outside of Christmas because, you know, dad or whatever family doesn't want to see you? This is easy. This is fun. This is, I can see it. There's an opponent and I can go against it. But what do you do against someone who clutches a purse a little bit tighter? What do you do against a policeman who pulls you over for something that you know you didn't do, but is adamant that you did? What do you do against someone who makes a funny, a good humored racial joke that you would laugh on any occasion, but why this time doesn't it feel funny anymore? Why, what is it about the delivery of that joke
that makes
it feel like difficult to digest? And again, you can't talk about it. What happened to me when I was in Montana with that billiards table is inexplicable. Had I gotten mad as a child and been like, you're doing this because I'm black. What do you mean? What are you talking about? I didn't do anything wrong. I just said that you can't have a table because you're too young. I had a young kid coming. Excuses, excuses, excuses. There's no opponent. So when someone says, I don't like you because you're black, you've given me a weapon I can use. You've given me fuel for my anger. But when you don't—
Because you've made them the victim now.
Yeah, you know? You've given me something to work with.
I do have one question that's really burning on my heart. Savannah, you alluded to some of the thoughts that you've had about what it will be like when you have children.
Yeah.
And, you know, what will they look like? How will you feel, et cetera. And I just, that's something that really moved me with the Black Lives Matter movement was the fact that, like, in the midst of that, I became a mom and realizing that my child has to deal with all of this, even though my child is white. And I'm sure this one in my belly is also going to be white.
Your husband hopes so. I mean,
right, exactly. Right. I want to hear, like, Zach, have you thought about this? Do you think about this? Like, absolutely. What will this be like for your kids? What, like,
no,
what
so,
are you scared for them?
So I'm a very, like, again, I'm an understanding person. I take my time. I do logic because I was forced to. Savannah is incredibly passionate. Mm-hmm. The reason, and it's one of the things I love most about her. Mm-hmm. And what I learned is that I had burned out my passion to make myself palatable for everyone. Mm-hmm. And so when these things started happening, you know, George Floyd, the cases and trials that went on, you know, a runner is shot, a 14-year-old girl is shot when she's the one who called about the incident. A woman being, Brianna being shot in her own home. Mm-hmm. When these things are coming up, you feel that spark kind of in you and mm-hmm. you calm it. I realized that through Savannah, there are things that you can't be okay with. Mm-hmm. What my patience and tolerance was doing was breeding an environment for people who were doing wrong mm-hmm. to feel comfortable about being wrong. Right. I was allowing for them to be like, oh, Zach has justified the fact that I just did something monstrous. And if it comes from someone that looks black, well, then of course I must be perfectly fine because I've done something and a black person has forgiven me for it. Mm-hmm. And I realized that that can't be the case. So when my kids grow up, it'll be an understanding tolerance and understanding of others, but never allow someone to minimalize you for their own comfort and never, ever make yourself smaller so it's palatable for them.
Right.
And because I've learned what that does to me, and I learned that it kind of puts a seed in you and it makes you maybe not resentful, but it kind of festers in there and there's no cure. There's no outing of it until you can speak about it. So I know my kid, I'll be like, hey, listen, it's a crazy world out there. And I'm glad in a way that I grew up in that environment. I grew up in a looking different than my parents, but at least my kid will have a dad that looks like him or her. And I'll be like, listen, there may be some times where someone might say something like, oh, that's just because you're black. And you'll hear everyone in the class laugh because it's a funny joke. And it will take a lot of bravery and it'll be very difficult for you. But sometimes you need to be able to say, hey guys, that's not right. And you will have people who will be like, you can't take a joke. You just can't be serious. Oh my God, you're going to be one of those guys who gets mad over the small race jokes. They'll try to belittle you. They'll try to make you feel bad for what you just did. But you have to always stand up for yourself and understand that maybe it's just their environment or maybe they're doing it on purpose, but you have to educate them on the world that you want to live in. And I know that when I have my kid, I'll have to change the way I am as well. Some family members that say things, I'll have to correct them. I won't be angry about it, but I'll be like, listen, I'm going to have a kid and I will not allow them to be in your environment if you choose to be this way. I won't fight you on it yet. I'll give you some time. But when my kid comes into this world and you have that attitude, I won't associate myself with you because I've already spoken on that because I will not allow my kid to grow up in the world that I did in that toxic environment.
We had a recent situation probably within like a year or two where, again, someone very close to us who loves us, supports us, loves Zach dearly, said the N-word just in passing. And I had to tell someone else very important in my life, if you ever say that in front of my children, you'll never see us again. Like, listen to what I'm telling you. You will never see us again. Like, there's got to be a line in the sand. And it's so crazy to me. You know, I'm already a pretty controlling, dominant person in our relationship in general. But like, when he goes out to like run or something, I'm like, no, you can't. Like, I'm
sorry. Got me a safety belt, a vest.
Oh, like, no, the, let me tell
the,
you
the white or the yellow reflective ones.
I am never worried, really. Sorry, men, but I'm never worried about, like, okay, how do I say this? I'm not really thinking about your safety because you're big men who can usually protect yourself. I'm very much an advocate for like women's safety and things like that, as someone who has been sexually assaulted before. So, you know, I've never really thought about men, and that's probably not very woke of me either, but I never really thought about men, you know, protecting themselves, whatever. I've always kind of been trained like they can take care of themselves, which is something I should obviously think about more. But, you know, like when Zach goes out, like I have got him prepared for battle, and it's because he's Black. I literally have these little knives that go on his shoes. I have, like, okay, when we used to live in an apartment, there was a veteran cemetery, and he used to go run with a hoodie on late at night in the dark. And I said, you cannot do that anymore. And he's like, why? And I'm like, because there is a Black man running in a hoodie in a veterans thing. You've got your music on. What happens when the police says stop? You don't hear him. And then he shoots you because he doesn't ask any questions. Yeah. And so those kind of things absolutely terrify me. He went on a bike ride the other day. I wanted to follow him in my car.
And it was broad daylight.
Broad daylight. I wanted to follow him in my car. And we live in Memphis, which, yes, it can be dangerous, but we love Memphis. So, you know, a place that is very, it's got lots of Black people here. I am still scared for his safety. So those are things that I absolutely panic about, or people approaching Zach. And I will be the same way with my children times 10. I'm sure I'll be a psycho, but yes, you know, and I agree with Zach about how you do need to be empathetic and patient and calm. I also agree that, like, you roll up on me, I will shoot you in the middle of the head, like in between the eyes. Like, I don't care. You know, like, it comes to a point where it's like, enough is enough. Yeah. Enough is enough. And if you mess with me and my Black husband, you're going to fucking get it. Like,
I've never been in a fight, and I've consigned myself to know that if I get in a fight, it's because she started it. I know it. And I know it. It'll be like someone says something slighting and she's like, excuse me. And I'm like, baby, please. No.
The gun.
And the giant guy next to her like bows up. I'm like, God, I have to defend your honor.
The gun is on my side of the bed. Let's just say that. Okay. Somebody comes to our house.
Honestly, I'm a believer. I believe.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I'm like, we will throw down. So
yeah, Savannah can take you out. Trust me. And I was like,
yeah,
almost knock bitches out in Ybor for me.
I'll be checking on them. Like, listen, you're trying to rob me. Are you okay? You've got 911. It's okay. Yeah. Holding her back.
One time somebody tried to scam Zach with magazines a long time ago. So I jumped out of the bathtub, threw on like a muumuu and grabbed a knife and chased after him. And I was like, you come near me or my husband again.
Down 3 flights of stairs to another apartment building, up 2 flights of stairs to confront this kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm a psychopath.
I just want to say something about the George Floyd, the thing. One of the things that really shakes me was that there were people standing there.
Yeah.
Cops, yeah. Bystander. I mean, we have like multiple different video views, you know, and something that really hit me was like, what would I have done if I was standing there? And I know that some, like, even some of the people who gave testimony said they were shouting at the police. And
yeah.
Yeah, you try to stop,
feel like you can't touch the police, you know? But I took that sort of, for me, as like a bigger metaphor with the Black Lives Matter movement, is like, we are all standing there in a way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
You know what? I want to hear from you guys, you know, what can we do better as allies? Because I know I don't want to just stand there with the video. Not that that wasn't important. The video is, you know, one of the reasons why that guy was convicted, you know, and everything. But, you know, we don't just want to stand on the sidelines anymore.
Right.
And watch this happen. Like, I'm like so sick of it. I'm pissed, you know,
you have
been
to
pissed
say
for
something.
A while, but
you have to say something, because let me tell you again, with the whole Facebook thing, like it's been hard for me to lose people. And even though my life is better off without those kind of people, but let me show you a prime example this morning, right? This is, I know, in direct correlation with the verdict of George Floyd. I know so many white people who have told me in private that the way he was murdered was wrong, but have never said anything on social media. Now, yeah. Social media is not the end all be all. However, if you're going to tell me what you ate that day, because I don't give a shit, you know, you should at least be using your platform to speak out. So I had someone who I like just post something this morning, and it's about police officers. Okay. And I'm very thankful for police officers, but it says, we don't want your pity. I don't even ask for your respect. Let us do our jobs without killing us. Thank you, police officers of hashtag America. So my problem is you take time out of your day to post something like this, but you are fucking silent about the verdict of a man who was murdered in our street. You are racist. So look in the mirror and accept that and change, right? Your silence is deafening. Your silence is deafening. And
publicity. If you are not speaking up, how are we supposed to know that you're not with them? Like Alexander Hamilton, the quote, if you stand for nothing, like you'll fall
for anything, Burr, sir. but you know, like it's deplorable. You know, like one of my best friends, you know, we got in a huge fight. We stopped talking because, you know, I was told that my disdain for Trump was disdain for them. And it just makes me sad that people can't dissociate. Thank you. They can't dissociate from this Trumpism and speak out. Like, I just don't understand why you can't say something. And, you know, a really close person, you know, my mom, we'll talk about my mom and I, you know, she would use her Facebook sometimes and never speak up about issues. Mm-hmm. And it bothered me so bad. And I'm just like, mom, like, just say something. But it is scary to say something. As a white person, I'll go and say, it's not easy to stand up. It's not. I'm not playing the victim, but it's not easy. When I stood up, I lost people. And when I stood up, I was lonely. You know, when I stood up, I was looked down upon. But at the end of the day, my
loss sometimes costs something.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And to answer your question about what you can do, because I think coming to terms with something like as heavy as racism is hard for people to do. So the first thing you have to do is, and kind of like what you're saying, if you feel like something is difficult, like speaking up in a situation where you kind of knew you were supposed to, but you had fear, that is the moment you know that there's something wrong. You don't even have to call yourself racist, but know it's something wrong. If you are about to make a joke in a crowd full of people and you lower your voice, you're doing something that is wrong and you have to acknowledge that. When you start acknowledging those things, you can begin to grow. For people who, again, I meet a lot of people who are good people. I'm a good person. And yeah, sure you are. But you have to accept that. Why do you feel so uncomfortable when you see something, but you don't speak on it? You're afraid. Why are you afraid? If everything's okay, if racism doesn't exist, why don't you do X, Y, and Z? Because it is there. You just don't want to give it a voice. And the moment you do, that's when you can start talking about these things. That's when you can start moving forward. And I think that that's just an important thing for people to be able to do. But
God has called us to be brave people. He has called us to be brave people. Like Jesus came out against the Pharisees, and he was nailed to a cross because of it. This wasn't supposed to be easy. Being different is not supposed to be easy. It comes with consequences. It's supposed to be easy.
That's the whole thing. How many times do we hear that in messages that being Christian isn't supposed to be easy? We're not immune to trials and tribulations. I hear even on like the Christian side for people who are older and stuff, like, well, we've made progress. Like progress. And like, we can still do more. Like, we can still do more. There's still more work to be done. Like,
and one thing you can do is just say something to those who, your friends who are of color or your interracial couple friends, you know, like say something. Like, do you know what it would mean if that one of my best friends, if you know who we had that thing, if she would have just said once to me, like, I love you, I support you, I support Zach, I understand that y'all may have gone through things, I understand that this may be hard for your Black husband, like that would have meant the world to me.
And for me, it's a, like the George Floyd case, right? Do you acknowledge that this was wrong? I guess most people would acknowledge that if someone was knelt on the throat. And I mean, I can only imagine what it feels like to slowly die for 9 minutes.
As horrible. You call out to your mother.
Horrible, right? Horrible. If you feel worried about putting that on your Facebook, why?
Yep.
Why? And I think that's where it can start. Honestly, if you see something like that happen, don't racially charge it. Ask yourself, why didn't I post something that is so like horrific? Mm-hmm. And that's when you understand there's a problem, because if you post that, you recognize that that might insult somebody. And then you have to ask yourself the follow-up question. Well, why would that insult someone? Why would me ever talking about someone who died make me or my stance something bad? That is the problem. That is the issue. That is the root of everything. There should never be a situation or a conversation you can't have that would demonize you. And then now ask yourself, man, that was really hard for me, and I'm completely separate from it. Imagine if you were Black.
Well, I was talking to my mom yesterday, and I was like, imagine. Why do I feel
it's wild? It really is. It's wild to think about that. You're like, man, I really am okay whether this happens or not, because it'll never happen to me. But imagine that actually being something that could happen to me and people argued against it. Can you imagine your father, your mother, your loved one, and them, you know, being they're being knelt upon, and you're like, this person was, can you imagine how heart-wrenching that is? And for someone to walk up and be like, well, he did have fentanyl in his system. Can you imagine if you were standing there listening to that, what would you do to that person had they been like, well, he does look big and aggressive. Like yeah. you would throw hands. You would tear your hair out. You would want to take a gun if you had it in your hand and shoot every person in that moment. You would be so emotionally charged and then recognize that you can't do it. You have to sit there. You can't just be like, oh, well, we have to argue against the fact that you have to argue. You can't feel better and then do that for your whole life. There's no way to feel better about what's happening. You can't vent what you're feeling because that's aggression. And no, that doesn't exist. So then you get angry and you get mad and you have no outlet. So then when something like this happens, hell yeah, I went to the streets. Hell yeah, I threw something through a window because that was an inanimate object. If I wanted revenge, if I really wanted to hurt you, I would go into your house and take out everyone. Thank God I didn't want revenge. What I was looking for is a way to vent what I was feeling for years and years and years, and everyone around me felt it as well. And the only reason it was radical for you was because you've never felt it. You can't understand raw passion in its form. You can understand it when your favorite baseball team wins and you all take to the streets and topple over a car. That was a crazy night. But you can't understand the intensity and the catalyst that caused it for all of your brothers and sisters. And you look around and you see them in your eyes and you realize you felt it too, haven't you? And you don't even speak about it. And you look and you felt it too. What are we supposed to do about this? I need to get this out. I mean, that could have been a horrific. And again, I don't condone looting. I don't condone violence. I'm a very pacifistic person, but I have also had those feelings where I go out to the yard and I work myself to death and I'm tired and sore. I remember when that happened with the young man that got shot, the boxer who was running. I went out running that night and I remember how like my legs were dying. And I remember right at the end, everything hurt because I was just running because I was just, God, I was filled with something. And I remember about to give up. And I was like, no. And I kept pushing because I was like, he can't do that anymore. And I had to get it out of me. And that's what it's all about. You know, how, you know, when we talk about these events and when people get angry and they don't, God, why did you act that way? When you are poked, it doesn't matter. But if you get poked in the same place, a poke becomes an irritation, becomes a bruise, becomes an indention, becomes, if you touch me like that again, I will snap on you.
Yeah.
And there's no way to get it out except for music. So now I'm going to say, fuck the police because you took out someone wrongfully and I watched it on my block. And now I'm going to say, fuck you for doing that. I'm going to express it in dance and I'm going to get this out. I'm express it in radical movement so you can see what's going on because I need to stir you because you've been complacent. That passion that is in you, you can't feel, but I'm now going to show it to you. This is what I feel. And then when people get bothered by it, you've invoked an emotional response. That's when it quiets down. That's when the riots begin to stop, because now you understand. Now you can begin to feel. And when people begin to feel that there is a problem, that's when the solution can come to a head. But until then, until you can stir people, until you can make them understand, it doesn't matter.
And when you post about how looting and rioting is so wrong, but you don't post about how a man murdered for 10, or, you know, being knelt on his neck and being murdered for 10 minutes straight, when you don't post about that, I know everything I need to know about you. Mm-hmm. I know everything I need to know about you. Mm-hmm. Whether you even try to be, you're fucking racist if you do not say that this shit is wrong. Because Hitler did not start killing the Jews. That's not how he started off. He didn't throw everybody in a gas chamber from day one. He started by leading people into the abyss and forcing them to, and convincing them to be complacent. And you know how many of my white friends I know who are complacent racist right now? And they don't even know it.
All right, Zach, Savannah, this has been an insane episode. I thank you so much for having you guys on. These conversations have been absolutely amazing. I know our audience is going to, you know, feel something, wanted to, like, I know I'm feeling something right now. I just wanted to, again, thank you guys so much for coming on and sharing your stories. Is there anything else that you want to say before we wrap up? I, again, just thank you guys.
I'm going to plug my book. nothing radical, nothing crazy. If people are listening to this, number one, thank you for getting all the way to the end. And thank you. Thank you, Janet. Thank you, Sage, for bringing us on. I think the only thing that I would like from this is not even like a rally, not a call to arms. I'm too relaxed for something like that. I just like a moment to realize that maybe in all things, we've probably made a mistake or an oversight. We sometimes lack that ability to see what we do, and it can be a bit of a vacuum. At most, I would like is for people to take a second and ask themselves, in those moments where you feel something is wrong, do you have the courage to acknowledge it? And do you have the courage to speak on it?
It's about, and if you see something, you say something, just like they say it, like in airports, if you see something, say something. Well, that's when your Black brothers and sisters are being murdered. Maybe you, if you see something, you should say something.
And this goes to everything. Every time someone makes a passing gay joke, every time someone says, okay, really? All of those things, when you make those jokes and you laugh and you have that snide little laugh, and you know, in that little moment, there's that little, that is your human conscious knowing that that is wrong. So just don't make a fight of it. Just have the courage to be like, what do you mean? What do you mean do the curtains match the drapes or whatever it is? You know, what do you mean by that? Force them to acknowledge or explain in a non-inflammatory.
Racism, yeah.
And if they own up to it, then you know, okay, cool. You're a monster. You know you are. You don't need that monster in your life. But just do that. Just question it. And I think that a lot of people will get a lot better.
And all I want is for people to not hide behind their Bibles to be bigots. That's mainly what I want. You know, you cannot hide behind the word of God and also bring shame to the word of God. If live like Jesus. I'm not saying I'm a great Christian. Honestly, it's hard for me to identify as a Christian sometimes. I love Jesus. That's all I know. And the people that claim to be Christian in my life are the furthest things from Jesus that I know. And that's sad for me. And that's sad for America, because that means there's a lot of people who are turning away from the church, turning away from God, and it's our fault. It's white evangelical Christians' fault. So take a stand, and take a stand against politicians who come out against women and people of color and other minorities. Say something, have the courage to say something, reach out to those that may be going through something, and just grow some balls. It's hard, but it's necessary, because you are isolating and making people feel so alone with your silence. The people that you love, the people you send Christmas cards, you are isolating them with your silence.
Zach, Savannah, I just want to say again, thank you so much for being with us today. And I don't take it lightly that you've shared so many personal stories, so many personal experiences. Savannah, you've already been crying on the show, but I imagine that there, maybe Zach later is going to go just like take the lawnmower and like
weed whack manually.
Get a weed whack. I don't know, but I really hope that you two have some self-care plan for today after sharing just some of that. And again, we just want to say thank you. We do not take it lightly that you have shared so openly, and we hope and pray that our listeners receive what you've shared really well. For sure.
Thank you guys.
And sorry for talking so long.
No, this was amazing. You guys have brought up so many different things. Like, talking about family so much is a perfect thing to kind of segue into next week's topic. For those of you who aren't aware, Mother's Day is coming up. So
get your cards.
Here's your warning, because next podcast episode is Who's Your Mama? Who's Your Mama? Until next time, have a great day. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to Florida Grown Femmes on where you listen to your podcast, on Spotify, iTunes, Google, Podomatic, wherever you go. Please subscribe and please leave us a review. And you can come back to our channels on Instagram or Facebook of Florida Grown Femme Podcast and tell us about what you thought about this episode. We love hearing from you guys. Until next week, bye-bye.